that's the real opportunity, that we can ride this wave, if you like, of decarbonization, adoption of renewable energies and improvement in technologies and acceleration of technologies to create prosperity.
Are you interested in bio-urbanism? What do you think about Earth as a spaceship? How can we learn system thinking for a more holistic approach? Stay tuned for answers from Adrian McGregor.
What is the future for cities?
Do you want to learn more about them?
Do you want to know how others think about them?
Do you want to be part of the conversation?
Then this is the right place.
Welcome to What is the Future for Cities podcast. Today, I will interview Adrian McGregor, the founder and chief design officer at McGregor Coxall. We will talk about his vision for the future of cities, bio-urbanism, prosperity, adaptability, climate forecasting with digital twins, and many more. So let's start with a proper introduction. Adrian McGregor is founder and chief design officer at McGregor Coxall, a biolab-led urban design, landscape architecture, and environment firm located in Australia and the UK. Adrian is the author of Bio-Urbanism, Cities as Nature. Practicing globally, he is a bio-urbanist, landscape architect, and adjunct professor at the University of Canberra. Nominated as one of Sydney's 100 most creative people, he designs new cities and helps existing cities enhance prosperity by planning for climate resilience. He received the Prime Minister of Australia's Award for Urban Design and has helped McGregor Coxall receive more than 200 international design awards. And with that, Adrian, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for your time. I highly appreciate your appearance on the podcast. Let's jump right in. What does future of the city mean to you?
Thanks so much, Fanny. It's great to speak with you. I'm in Sydney in Australia at the moment, and actually I just mentioned that we're sweltering here at the beginning of spring, and all of a sudden we seem to be in a heat wave. We're seeing temperatures soar all around the world, and I think it's impacting all of us. So what does that mean about the future of cities? What is how we as citizens of cities and people can actually continue to have prosperity in the places that we live around the world, in our communities, and how can we enjoy our future and tackle some of the challenges that we're facing as a species, if you like, right across the planet.
What does the city mean to you?
If we go right back to the history of the city, in my book, Bio-Urbanism, I actually trace the history of cities going all the way back to the Fertile Crescent of the Middle East. And the first cities were created really by being able to produce food, sedentary agriculture, if you like. So prior to that, humans moved around and we went from place to place by hunting and gathering. So the first cities were created when we learned how to actually grow and produce our foods and make goods for ourselves in a single location. And from there, of course, that created trading. So from there, we had our first economies. And the advent of those kind of financial models and trading arrangements meant that cities could then trade between each other and people could trade between each other. So that really birthed the first cities. And interestingly enough, they are all in places that were very fertile. So there were places where you had amazing, rich and fertile soils. You had abundant water sources. You had the kind of environmental resources that are required to sustain people in a place. So they were the first elements, if you like, that allowed us to begin cities. And of course, today cities are now the biggest habitat that we live in. So we've created these habitats for ourselves. More than 50% of us live in these cities or habitats. And that's increasing as we move more and more away from our rural areas and countryside into cities in the seek greater prosperity for employment, for social connections, for friendships, for family situations. So there's a great gravitas that cities have, a great pull in attracting people to places where we dream about having a better future.
Is the city the pure background for human life? You describe the city as the habitat for where we live. Is the city purely the background for our lives?
I think that cities are both the background, but also the foreground for our lives. We're really highly dependent on them now. The resources that they provide for us are ubiquitous, and our attachment to them for all the things that we need is now crucial. Our health, our food, our social engagements and interactions, all of these things cities provide for us. Yes, they're a background in terms of providing the infrastructure, if you like, for us to exist day to day. But I think in the foreground, they're also driving us towards innovation, ideas, culture. They're important places where we come together to develop concepts and new ways of thinking. And it's the same. Cities have provided that role right from the beginning of time, where we've had the great civilizations, the Greeks and the Romans and many others that have created incredible philosophies and ways of thinking that have moved us along as a species.
We will get back to the prosperity because I'm very interested in what prosperity means to you. But just entertaining my curiosity and my humor, I read Yuval Harari's Sapiens, where he explains how grains are the most successful beings, basically, in evolution, because they convinced humans to settle down, leave their hunter-gathering lifestyles behind, and cultivate grains for their own benefits. Do you think that humans gained from settling down and creating these cities to create food, create these trade routes?
Look, I think absolutely our ability to remain in one place for greater lengths of time has allowed us to develop intellectually because we've been able to focus our energy on, instead of gathering food, hunting, and actually sustaining ourselves, we've been able to divert that because of the shared roles and responsibilities in the city. It's allowed people to focus on different things. So grain, yes, I would say that certainly it's been one of those things that allowed us to sustain ourselves in a single place. But also, interestingly, I think that DNA itself, of course, is a very interesting way to think about ourselves and genes and the sort of the mutation and transformation of genetic materials, even in ourselves over time, has been incredible. And if you look at evolution, of course, we go way back to the earliest forms of life, even the creation of the first cells and the first oxygen-generating cells that allowed for the pathway for us to develop. So the pathway of DNA also is very interesting in how it has shaped us and continues to shape us as we evolve as a species. So, yeah, I think, and of course, plants have genetic content as well. So I think, yeah, there's a very interesting conversation there around why we are the way we are and what we do as a species and as a life form and how that makes us different from other forms of life.
So basically, cities helped us leave Maslow's pyramid's lowest step and continue our evolution towards the higher steps like intellectual, religion, and other aspects. Instead of focusing on the shelter and food, we can focus on the higher aspects of our life, as I understand.
That really describes, I think, where we are today. But I think moving forward and looking at the future, that arrangement, if you like, or development could change and shift rapidly because we're now dealing with an unstable climate. So for the very first time, Homo sapiens as a species are going to have to exist in an environment that we have not existed in before. So there's a great deal of uncertainty lying ahead for us, even in the short to medium term. So what does that mean for people, for Homo sapiens? And are we going to start spending more and more of our time in going back to dealing with environmental impact? Less time in leisure and theoretical pursuit. So this is a big question, I think, for us as a species in a very uncertain future.
That just sounds very reassuring. Before we jump into the fears and concerns, I would love to understand, what do you mean by prosperity? What does prosperity mean to you?
I think prosperity, for me, is a term that I use with reference to people and equity, if you like, the sharing of resources, materials, wealth, and having some sort of balance, if you like, between how people live and what they use. Then the other part of it is the environmental prosperity. How can we live in tandem with the ecosystems that sustain us and the environment sustain us? The prosperity of the human species is entirely reliant on the commensurate prosperity of the environment that sustains us. And if we have no environment left, we don't have the natural capital that we need to support our cities and ourselves, then there will be a reduced prosperity. So for me, prosperity is a double-sided thing. And part of that is acknowledging our connection with the environment that sustains us.
Just to understand it correctly. So you say that prosperity has two prongs. One is human's prosperity, and the second is environmental prosperity. I would love to understand whether these are necessarily connected. So can people be prosperous without environmental prosperity? And can environment be prosperous without human prosperity?
I would say that Homo sapiens as a life form and as a species are entirely dependent on the environment for survival. If there is no environmental prosperity, then our ability to survive is greatly impacted. Can the environment survive without the species of Homo sapiens? Yes, of course, and it will. The Earth will continue to evolve regardless of what we do on it, and our impact is a blip in time, really, in terms of the evolution of the planet. The way I describe it too, and in my book, I talk about Buckminster Fuller and the idea of the fragility of spaceship Earth. We've all watched the movies, we've all watched sci-fi, where you're in the space station and you are reliant upon the garden to produce oxygen and fresh food for the inhabitants of the space station to survive. And then something happens and there's a loss of the greenhouse, if you like, in the space station. And then, of course, people start to die. Spaceship Earth is no different. And Buckminster Fuller described it very well. And the term spaceship Earth, I think, is really an important one for us to understand. If we pollute and destroy the things that spaceship Earth has that sustain us, then clearly our survival will be impacted. I think it's a great way to think about the planet and our relationship with the species that we share on our spaceship.
It's also a very interesting question then. Why do we talk about environmental conservation when the environment can live without us, but we can't live without environment? So why not talk about human conservation? Maybe our life is much more threatened in these environmental changes that we are causing through climate change and rapid urbanization and aging populations. As we started to talk about them, what are your three biggest fears or concerns regarding the future of cities?
Look, the first fear, I think, is one that we all share, and that is climate emergency and the impact that extreme weather is having now on a daily basis to cities globally. I follow, it's called Volcaholic on Twitter, formerly Twitter, now X. And every day there's a post about either a flood, recently a flood impact globally. And it's really quite frightening to see the frequency and severity of events that are occurring now. And we've known for a long time, science has told us for many years that this was the future. And I think there's been a lot of uncertainty in the climate models or agreement in the climate models, but not the end climate projection, if you like, but how quickly these temperature changes are going to change the weather cycles and the kind of the big cycles in terms of earth sciences that are driving our climate. That's the unknown. So it's difficult to know how quickly and predict what the triggers are and then how these dominoes fall. Because once the cascade starts, we don't know how quickly these dominoes are going to fall. And I think that's one of the things that the science is grappling with because it's unknown territory. There seems to be a lot of shared consensus on the end impacts and what's likely to occur in the longer term. But how quickly this unfolds is, I think, something that we're all looking at. You know, you only have to turn the news on, the world news now, to see the kind of frequency and severity of impact that we're facing across the world. So that is my biggest fear. And of course, I think it's everyone's fear, and especially for young people, I think they're very concerned about what our generations are leaving behind for them to deal with. And I think this is where this question of equity really comes in. And the question of liability in terms of things that have been done to our atmosphere that we know are impacting down the track. What's the liability? What's the impact to future generations? I think these are Big question. So that would be my biggest fear, is how do we deal with these things? But out of that fear, I think, comes opportunity too, of course, because as a species, we are ingenious. We can create outcomes when we put our minds to it. You only have to look at COVID, for example, to see collectively how we work together globally to beat something. I don't know why we're not doing the same with the climate emergency. It's strange, really. I don't understand why there isn't the same impetus, if you like, to dealing with that. And perhaps it's the time frame. It comes down to the frog in the boiling water. It won't jump out till it's gone as that water gets hotter and hotter. I think that's certainly the biggest challenge and concern that I have right now.
Why do you think that liability is an important part? From my point of view, it's very important to stop pointing fingers and focus on the solutions. Why do you think that liability is important?
I think liability is really a focus for those that are most heavily impacted. For example, the Pacific nations that are impacted by sea level rise, communities moving away from the lands that they've lived right through the generations. And they're starting to ask the questions and say, well, we didn't cause this pollution, but our homelands are disappearing under the sea. So surely, like we have in all law, when somebody creates an outcome that impacts the livelihoods or property, for example, property rights of someone, then in our legal system, there is always a way to attribute compensation, if you like, and responsibility. So they're the things I think that are countries like that are driving this conversation around liability. And this will continue. And ultimately, what we're going to see, and in fact, what we're already seeing, and in Australia, we already have, is climate refugees. We've had one area here in the Northern Rivers that flooded twice within a few months, and people still have not moved back to their homes and they can't get insurance. These properties that have been, that are owned by people, they're financial instruments that protect them. There are laws to protect them. We're going to see more and more discussion around liability. And of course, we're seeing now young people get together and start to begin class actions. We've just seen California beginning to take action against the fossil fuel industry for the damage that it's causing and the costs that it's causing to repair infrastructure and public facilities following extreme events driven by climate change. So we will see more and more of this, and it's just an emerging issue, but it will escalate.
Interesting, because these actions from these activists, for me, translate more to, come on, guys, let's do something finally and stop the wrongdoing. But again, not about, you have been polluting for 20 plus years here. Why have you been doing? And give me some money to make that wrong right. And again, for me, it's more about stop doing the wrong. It's creating momentum towards solution. But I understand what you say, that it starts conversations and it's very important to find shared responsibility. I can experience that pointing fingers can also shut down people who otherwise might have been convinced with data, with information, that we could work together towards a better future. But since we are pointing fingers, this is just shutting down and it just creates resistance.
I think it's actually quite a simple concept, because if you pollute a river, so you're an industry and you pour chemical content into a river, you kill all the fish. It goes into the potable drinking supply of the people who are downstream and they die. It's a breach of our laws, our environmental protection laws. Carbon is no different. It is a gaseous pollutant that is being emitted by people who are making money from it, and that is then causing people to be impacted. I think it's quite a simple comparison that carbon emissions, greenhouse gases, are a pollutant. And now we know they're a pollutant. And that pollution is, in fact, it's increasing, not even decreasing. There are more fossil fuel projects planned, and they're very large. And you only have to listen to the UN, just look at the data around our projects. And unfortunately, it's like giving up smoking. Be very good at convincing people to stop smoking, but we're not succeeding with climate change, unfortunately, and there's a lot to do.
So your biggest fear is the climate emergency, and you mentioned that opportunities stem from this, like ingenuity and I added innovation. What are other opportunities you are excited about regarding the future of cities?
Look, I think that cities emit 75% of the world's greenhouse gases. So they're the biggest polluter. If you aggregate scope 1, 2, and 3 emissions, they are the cause of climate change. Therefore, they must also be the solution. So if we can solve decarbonization and the carbon emissions of cities, then we will solve climate change. So for me, that's the biggest opportunity. And I think that we see around the world some cities being really progressive and pushing very hard to achieve incredible things very rapidly. That's exciting because that's transitioning into green economies, it's transitioning jobs, it's transitioning all sorts of technologies, it's driving investment into technologies. So I think that's the real opportunity that we can ride this wave, if you like, of decarbonization, adoption of renewable energies and improvement in technologies and acceleration of technologies to create prosperity. And I think that's really exciting because it gives us all something to focus on. But it needs to be done. Obviously, we need to stop emitting fossil gases. So coal, gas, and oil need to be scaled back rapidly so that we can invest in technologies. And the other thing we've got to do is move the subsidies. So there are still trillions of dollars in subsidies going into fossil fuels globally. And a lot of that's coming from government to prop up, keeping costs down from fossil fuels. So we've got to move that money into renewables. And that's got to happen tomorrow, really rapidly. And unfortunately, it's not happening at all at the moment, and that's a problem. So as soon as we shift the flow of global finance from subsidizing the polluting industries into subsidizing the solutions, then wow, what an incredible set of opportunities we have to work on together. That's the exciting thing, I think, that cities have in terms of all of us working in the jobs that we have and what we're trying to do together as a set of communities and citizens. I think that's super exciting.
It's also a very good question when design comes into the picture. You mentioned that around your area, there was repeated flooding and people can't move back. At some point, we need to ask the question whether short-term resilience or long-term sustainability is the way we want to organize our life. What do you think? How resilience and sustainability are connected?
I think that resilience is the ability for us to bounce back from shocks. I talk about cities. So how rapidly can a city recover from an extreme event? And part of that, a lot of that is a result of how well it planned to accommodate that shock in the first place. I just finished reading a book about Michael Bloomberg's legacy for New York and the incredible work that he did when he was mayor with a team around building resilience and looking at how to create storm-proof New York. And then we've just seen it flood again just in the last few days, the last week. Subways flooded again. I think that the interesting thing is how we can now use climate forecasting. So we have amazing data from the IPC, from the Copernicus model. In Australia, we have another model called NARCLIM, which is a finer grain set of kind of data that scales down the larger metrics to a local level. So we do have incredible climate projection models available to us as we design cities and plan cities. And that's very interesting because we can now create digital twins of cities, which is kind of a metaverse model, if you like, or a digital model of a physical city. And what that allows us to do is then overlay climate projections using the science modeling that we have. And we can actually look at the future impacts of extreme weather on the city. Once we know that, then we can start to prioritize where are the most vulnerable people? Where are the most vulnerable communities? Where are the highest densities of people that are going to be impacted by sea level rise, flood, by urban heat, et cetera? And we can start to create plans around, all right, we don't have unlimited amounts of money. So how can we actually prioritize and plan our resilience into places where we can get the most impact? And I think that's what we really need to be working on much more rapidly at the moment and investing our time, cities investing their time to create plans, working with the communities to really be also open about where the risk lies. I think there's been a great hesitancy to produce public materials that actually uncover or make public where the risk lies. And because people cities are very scared about that risk. It comes back to that liability issue that we spoke about earlier. We've got to start being honest about projecting the risks, overlaying it, and then working together to build resilience in our cities. And that's really creating design interventions. In my book, I talk about the environmental crisis is a design crisis. So we've engineered and designed our cities in a way that makes them vulnerable to climate risk. And that needs to change very rapidly. We have to change the way that we design, the way that we plan. And my book, Biourbanism, I talk about systems thinking, which is how do we actually acknowledge that a city is a system of systems? And if we impact one system, we are going to have knock-on impacts to other systems. And we've been ignorant of that before, but that needs to change. We need to actually understand that if you damage or you make change to one system, that it will flow on to others. So that's a big change. And that's how nature, you know, works. We know that if we impact one part of an ecosystem, that it will knock on to have impacts on others. And our cities are ecosystems. I define them in my book as nature. I think for some reason, Homo sapiens detached ourselves from the realization that we are part of nature. We have DNA. We are an organism. We make cities which are the same as termites build their cities. Beavers build their dams. Many animals build their homes and habitats. When we build our cities, then somehow they're not nature, but they have to be. They're in the planet, on the planet. They use natural capital, so they are nature. They're human-modified nature. They're not wild nature that we would have learned about when we were at school and universities, because we've had a vast impact to the wild places, wild biomes across the planet that now scientists are telling us that we live in the time of the Anthropocene, and that's the new era. So the Anthropocene, Anthrome being, you know, related to human, to us, and that's why I argue in the book that we need to classify cities as anthromes, which are human-modified nature. Once we understand and acknowledge that, then we can change the way we think, design, and plan, because we'll understand how they function a lot better. And that's quite a radical shift, because we still live in a world where we are humans. I think if you ask people, you're part of nature, they'd probably, what do you mean? I'm a human being. Nature's over there. I'm here. Are we connected? I don't think so. That's what I hear from a lot of people. So that is a problem. And cities probably been part of that problem where we have, over time, disconnected ourselves from the things that we need to survive. So going back to the origin of cities, the beginning of wheat, as you mentioned, and farming and some of those things, we knew that planted the crop and then had to harvest the crop and you'd see it come into the city because it was right there. But now we just go to the supermarket and we buy a thing in the plastic packet. The disconnect between what ecosystems provide for our survival in cities and where humans exist is now more and more apart than it ever has been. All these things connect.
You talk about system thinking. You talk about people being part of nature. What is biourbanism?
In a nutshell, I design biourbanism as a model that describes or classifies cities as a form of nature. It shifts us and our cities into acknowledging that they are a fundamental part of ecosystems and the environment. So a city is nature. And that's a bit of a radical concept for somebody to look at and say, what do you mean a city is nature? I'm looking at a skyscraper, a tall building, and I'm looking at that motorway. Are you telling me that's nature? Yes, it is. All those materials, all that natural capital, all those resources that we use to build that all came from nature. They're just a different form. I can look at a tree and say, well, that's timber, but I could look at the timber and say, I built something with it, but it's still all part of nature. It's been modified by humans. It's been engineered. And if we're not around, it turns into something very different. And again, you mentioned, Fanny, earlier about, does the environment need humans? Well, no, of course it doesn't. And I spent some incredible time moving around Detroit. So I went there about 10 years ago, and I went to Brightmoor and some of the places that are really impacted by urban blight. And of course, that's the Rust Belt of the US industrial cities. In fact, that was obviously car manufacturing and car industry, but places that were entirely dependent on those industries and those economies. So once they fell over and the jobs and employment were not there, people left. In fact, Detroit went into administration and went bankrupt. And if you look at the streets, they're completely overgrown. So you might find one remaining house in a whole suburb. You drive down the street or you walk down the street and there's nothing there. It's just nature is consuming it again. So it really opens your eyes to realizing that the city is a part of nature because you can see it. it's there. I encourage people to go and look, really, to reinforce this concept of city's nature. But it's also quite really confronting too, because you could see the social impact that this change in economy and, of course, the riots and the all sorts of things that they faced as a city has been really difficult. So then returning that city, retrofitting it, reinvigorating it and getting it to move ahead, of course, is tough. It's difficult, but there are innovations and people working together on bringing that community that's still there and, you know, reinvigorating their city. Interesting lessons for me as I walked around.
Biourbanism is a model which classifies cities as form of nature. We need to think in systems and we need to accept that people are also part of nature, not just we are outside of nature. What are the three biggest strengths regarding the future of cities?
I think that people are adaptable, and we as a species have already shown a great deal of resilience. We evolve, we change. So because Homo sapiens are the managers and operators, designers and builders of cities, that means that we can improve what we do, and we can design in smarter ways, and we can harness and learn from nature. So I think that's a really amazing opportunity for us. And we're doing that. You're seeing really rapid shifts at the moment in the way that cities are being constructed and even the conversations around how they're powered, how they're operated. So the sort of nature-based solutions, if you like, are becoming talked about more and more. We're talking about biomimicry. We're looking at nature for the ideas to drive our own technologies. Photosynthesis harnesses the sun, and that's what's driving our renewable energy in terms of solar panels and how we look at that. So there's a huge amount for us to learn from nature and how it works. And that's really exciting. And I think that there's really rapid change. We're seeing sustainable timber construction becoming really rapidly adopted. We're seeing big changes in energy efficiency in buildings. We're seeing now emerging laws around embodied energy and the amount of carbon that goes into the construction of buildings and infrastructure. We're seeing grey infrastructure retrofitted into green infrastructure. We're pulling out grey infrastructure, pulling out concreted culverts and returning to rivers. We're knocking down motorways and returning places to environments for people, streets for people, places where we can live and inhabit without being impacted so heavily by the motor vehicle. There's a huge amount going on at the moment. Place resilience, city resilience are really concepts that are building and growing rapidly. And of course, then they're being informed by data too. We can model things in a way that we never could. And now the digital twins and how we build these sort of foundational tools, if you like, for testing design outcomes, planning outcomes, looking at design scenarios, engaging with our communities on these changes, these very powerful models. So there's a huge amount of incredible technologies and thinking that are driving innovation in cities. And that's really exciting. And a lot of it's coming from the younger generations, I think. They've realized that things need to move rapidly. And that's why the fossil fuel industries are being resistant. And the faster that they transition and see that opportunities for themselves as well, power can be made in multiple ways. If you can stop fossil fuel extraction and move yourself into renewables, well, there's still plenty of good profit and revenue to be made from powering cities, but doing it a different way. So again, that's a great opportunity.
Is resilience enough? I usually ask this question when an interviewee talks about resilience, because we can go a step further to anti-fragility, where we not just survive the shocks, but also evolve and learn from the shocks and become better because of those shocks. Is resilience enough?
No, resilience isn't enough. There are a number of terms, but of course, adaptation is one. So how do we change the way that we inhabit places? Resilience is how do I survive against the shock? But of course, the best thing to do is prevent the shock in the first place. So that's why the decarbonization initiatives are so crucial, because that has to be the biggest focus. We need to rapidly decrease the amount of greenhouse gases that we're pouring into the biosphere and the troposphere. That's the most crucial thing. So we've got to be doing two things. We've got to be reducing greenhouse gas emissions into the troposphere, plus working on dealing with these temperature rises and increased uncertainty. We've got to be doing both.
Adrian, you have been very generous with your time and answers. What is your role in establishing the future of cities?
I think my role is, firstly, through my book, Biourbanism, is really to be a futurist and to propose a model for designing and planning cities that acknowledges what an anthrome is and helps us to create better cities. That's, I think, an important one for me. And then the second thing is that I'm a designer and I have already designed one city in China. I'm working on another city. And these, for me, are incredibly exciting opportunities. So I love to engage in design cities using the systems thinking of the biourbanism model to drive that innovation and create prosperity. So that's something that I'm involved in through McGregor Cox on my firm. And we're engaged in projects all around the world. We're building digital twins, we're doing planning, we're doing urban design work, we have environmental scientists. So we're using the systems thinking, city resilience and place resilience as concepts to improve retrofit cities or design new cities. So that's, I think, again, part of my role. And I think also advocacy. So speaking to people like you, Fanny, around these concepts and how we can work together, communities and cities around the world to improve the habitats that we live in. Our cities are our own. They're ours. We own them. The public parts of them anyway. And the public parts constitute a very large proportion of our cities. I'm sure there's private landowners, but there's a lot of public lands as well. So it's really interesting. And for me, drivers, if you like, in my professional career, you know, I'm really excited about continuing to advocate, speak, think, design, and work with city leaders, mayors, and clients around the world on helping to make cities better.
Before we jump into the last question, why did you start working with this idea of biourbanism?
That's a good question. So my profession, or my degree, is landscape architecture. Actually, the very first book, the text that I studied in my first unit, or one of my first units in first year university, was called Human Ecology. And it actually detailed ozone layer, it detailed greenhouse carbon emissions, greenhouse gases. I had a very early introduction into the concept of the environment and of people and how we coexist. So that was formative in shaping part of my thinking from a very kind of early part of my training. And then through landscape architecture, working on projects around the world, I won a competition for a very large part of an international competition early in my career for 23 kilometers of the inner part of Sydney. And really that competition win was based on systems thinking. It was based on solving a local problem by taking a regional approach and acknowledging that the systems, the regional systems, were the key to solving the local problems and harnessing those. That unlocked this seat around thinking larger and scaling up to get to the city level. This kind of urban ecology combined with the landscape architecture thinking as well through people like Ian McCarg, Design with Nature, which is a very instrumental formative book in the 1970s. These kind of philosophies, if you like, really had some influence on me. And then biourbanism emerged through research teaching at universities, and it really started to come together. And eventually I conceived this model, and it became clear to me what a city was and how they function. So then I started the journey of the book, which was 15 years. So it was a very long period of time that I worked on it. And my thinking changed along that time as well. Yeah, it's been a very exciting journey, but that's how it began. And they were the seeds that sowed the biourbanism concept for me.
And thank you so much for sticking with this thinking for a long time, because it's very important for our cities in the future and for us, for human preservation, not just environmental preservation. Adrian, you have been, again, very generous with your time and answers. Do you have any closing comments or requests for the audience?
Talking, having conversations around city resilience and prosperity are really important. We all can influence our city leaders and our politicians. We all can utilize our own thinking, our own intellect to create solutions for the challenges that we have. So I encourage everyone to get involved in these things and be passionate about advocating for the future of not only yourselves, but your children as well, and those generations that are coming through. We shouldn't be pessimistic. We should see the opportunities and move into those opportunities and be part of the solution and not the problem. I think that's what's crucial for all of us.
Thank you so much, Adrian.
Thanks so much for having me, Fanny.
It was really interesting to hear from Adrian about bio-urbanism as cities being part of nature, not to mention his description of prosperity. Paul Satur talked about his understanding of prosperity in episode 135. You can find out more about Adrian online, or the links are in the show notes. What was the most interesting part for you? What questions did arise regarding Adrian's approach to the future of cities? What have you learned from this interview? Let me know on Twitter at WTF4Cities or on the WTF4Cities.com website where the transcripts and show notes are available. You can also subscribe on the website not to miss any new episodes and leave some feedback. I hope this was an interesting interview for you as well, and thanks for tuning in.
What is the Future for Cities podcast?